Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. Well, where to begin? Late Thursday, a state judge threw out the legislature's Legislative Information Office lease. This week, Governor Walker has revised the state deficit by some $300 million more due to low oil prices, and he's upped his urging for a state tax plan this year. Lawmakers are wrestling with funding for the proposed Alaska Gas Line project, and federal officials are reviewing environmental study plans for another major project, the Susitna-Watonna Dam. We'll have a lot to talk about today, but first, let's introduce our guests. Andrew Kitchenman is Alaska Public Media's state government reporter in Juneau, appearing by video link from KTOO. Hello, Andrew. You hear me?
Good morning, Ellen.
Okay, good morning, Andrew.
Hello.
And Muhsin Ghitabi is an economist with ICER, and he's co-author of a recent study on the effects of the state fiscal deficit on Alaska's economy. Hello, Muhsin.
Hi, Ellen. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us. This ought to be a lively discussion. Let's start with Andrew down there in Juneau, because yesterday, Thursday, there was a very sudden news announcement. A Superior Court judge has thrown out the legislature's Legislative Information Office lease in Anchorage, and that is the result of a lawsuit, a public interest lawsuit filed by Jim Gottstein against the state legislature and the landlord of the LIO building. And Superior Court Judge Patrick McKay, I believe, decided that the LIO lease was invalid because it had been put out as a sole lease. No, it was a no bid. And the judge said that was against state procurement codes. So what are you hearing, Andrew? What's the scuttlebutt in Juneau? How is the legislature taking that?
Well, interestingly, even though it was technically a loss for the state, I think for the legislature at this point in time, they're content to have this lease declared void. Essentially, they've been rethinking the lease and the whole situation there. And this maybe makes it a little bit easier where now they can make this decision as to whether they want to stay or buy the building or move to the Atwood building. And there's a little bit less of a legal uncertainty hanging over their heads.
So one of the issues all along was whether to go, whether to stay, whether to buy the building. And this sort of forces the legislature's hand, I would think. And are you hearing any opinions from the legislative council or any of the legislators down there as to what is the better choice of action?
Well, Senator Gary Stevens, who's the chairman of the Legislative Council, which oversees this, basically pointed out that the council had hired a consultant, Navigant, to look at the whole situation. And Navigant found that the state would save money if they moved to the Atwood building. But it really depends on the time frame that we're talking about and how much money it would cost for the state to essentially buy the LIO. And so there's still a possibility that if the state could get it, that's what Stevens was saying, is that it could still make financial sense depending on the details and what they can negotiate. It's still a possibility that they could buy the LIO, but you know that's still uncertain. So even though this was a big decision, the ultimate outcome is very much up in the air. Now, the Legislative Council is going to be meeting, I believe, on Monday. And so that will be very interesting to see what they do then.
Well, has anyone heard from Representative Hawker, who apparently negotiated the lease deal?
He put out a written statement yesterday in which he said that the lease was negotiated in good faith. He really just reiterated that point, basically noted that the court had found otherwise and really left it at that.
So there were there other aspects of the case that the judge ruled on? I don't think he did. Did the judge rule on any other aspects of that case? Well, you may have lost.
I don't have anything ahead.
No information on that. Let's bring Mucin in because just this week, Governor Walker did up the amount of the state deficit by some $300 million. And bringing it up to about $4 billion, or 4.1, I guess, to be correct. I would like to know, Mucin, you and Gunnar Knapp and Matthew Bremer have authored a ICER report on what this deficit is going to mean to typical Alaskans. You've got various scenarios, high-end, low-end, middle-end. First of all, does this news of an extra $300 million deficit, does that skew your report at all?
No, it doesn't change our findings, because one of the things that we did was, as you've correctly stated, we looked at a few different fiscal options, and we define a fiscal option as basically something that the legislature can do in order to close a portion of this budget gap. And then what we do is we look at these impact per $100 million raised, if you will. And so this news, all it does is scale the findings essentially upwards, right? And so because what we did was normalize those findings so that the legislature can understand what the implications would be on average Alaskans, on the economy as a whole, for every $100 million they raise from the respective options. And so if, for example, now we're trying to raise $4 billion instead of 3.8, you're basically multiplying up the numbers that we concluded in our report.
Okay, I'm going to say that the name of the report is The Economic Impacts of Alaska's Fiscal Options, and that can be found on the ICER website in draft form, and I think the final version will be out next week sometime on the website. So, Mucin, there's several scenarios in this report, 11, I think, in all, and it runs the gamut from the very lowest income to the maybe 10% highest incomes. And so what's a spread like that? What is that telling us? Go ahead.
It's important. It was important for us, like I said, to not only examine the fiscal options, but also ensure that we're looking at how these different fiscal options are going to affect Alaskans of different income groups. And so when we look at an income tax, for example, the amount of money that is paid by a high-income Alaskan as a result of an imposition of an income tax exceeds that of a low-income Alaskan. And so when we laid out the options, we wanted to make sure that we look at some government decisions, meaning some, for example, state government cuts, employment cuts, capital cuts, but we also wanted to look at how do the different tax options, and I'm including PFD reductions here as a tax option, affect different Alaska households. And so really when you look at the two extremes, from a tax standpoint, the income tax hurts, if you will, high-income Alaskans much more than it does low-income Alaskans because they have a higher marginal income tax. And the PFD takes the most, if you will, out of low-income Alaskans because the amount of the distribution represents a larger portion of their overall take-home income. But also, they tend to spend more off their disposable income.
Right. You mentioned the word tax, the tax word. Let's just say that the Governor Walker's plan has called for income tax, possibly a sales tax, and using some of the earnings of the permanent fund to balance the budget. Let's bring Andrew back in. Andrew, first of all, how is the legislature taking the news of the larger deficit? What are you hearing in June now?
There wasn't a huge reaction to the announcement of the larger deficit. One thing that's interesting is that in the last week or so, a lot of the focus has been on the various proposals related to making changes to the permanent fund. And if the legislature adopts what the one bill that's being sponsored by Senator Liesl McGuire, then that bill would draw money every year from the permanent fund for the operating budget, much like what Governor Walker is proposing. But it would draw a lower level of money. The governor was looking for about $3.3 billion from a combination of the permanent fund and some other funds, while McGuire's bill would only draw $2 billion per year, which would only be, of course, half of the $4 billion deficit that the state's facing. And Senator McGuire actually said that there is a virtue to there being a gap and not fully addressing the long-term shortfall this year, in that as long as there is a gap, then there's going to be a sort of downward pressure and a sort of political pressure on keeping spending down, while if everything was solved this year, then that might allow spending to be at a somewhat higher level than what many legislators would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, McGuire's bill is a step in Walker's direction, so to speak, but I'm hearing through news reports that the legislature in general is sort of recalcitrant, whereas Walker is demanding that the legislature come up with a sustainable plan this year. Many of them are still saying, well, we still have reserves, we can still wait another year. What do you know about that?
Yes. So the governor basically said this week, he didn't say this in so many words, but it was implicit that he would call for a special session, not only if they didn't have a sustainable fiscal plan, but that it needed to include certain elements. And one of the elements he was calling for was a broad-based tax. And really, the primary broad-based tax that he has proposed is an income tax. And that, of all of his proposals, is the one that has been met with the most solid and most across the board among the Republican-led majority in both houses opposition. That basically he's not being met with any sort of receptivity to an income tax. And it was interesting that he included that as, he didn't say an income tax, he said a broad-based tax, but he included a broad-based tax as a sort of a deal breaker for him. Now, he hasn't in this budget proposed a sales tax. That might be a more attractive option for legislators, but I wouldn't say it's attractive. I mean, it's not like there are majority legislators who are calling for loudly for a sales tax. Now, where this leaves the state is if the state was to draw on reserves, and particularly the constitutional budget reserve, that they could draw from that this year. And in fact, Walker proposes to draw from it this year, but he only proposes to draw about $400 million from it. And if they don't pass a proposal like his and they don't include an income tax, then the state would have to draw quite a bit more. There's about $8.5 billion in that reserve. So if they were to spend closer to $1 billion or more than $1 billion from it, that would really put a significant hit on it and perhaps put us on a path to exhausting it in a few years. And all of that is really a cause of concern for bond rating agencies. And that's a big deal, because if the bond rating continues, if the state's bond rating continues to decline, then it'll make it much more expensive for the state to borrow money.
Okay, thanks for that recap, Andrew. Nusine, I'd like to We are talking about the potential or the possibility of an income tax. Now, how does that fit in with your research? One of the scenarios, and of course you have looked at this tax broad-based. Sure. Tell me about what you're finding.
Well, so what we basically do is look at the economic impact of the imposition of an income tax, right? Just like we do for the other scenarios. And so what we're interested in is how does removing money from the pockets of Alaskans reverberate through the rest of the economy, right? And so, and what we do is from a very basic technical standpoint is that we're looking at how people spend money, right? And then we're taking a certain amount of dollars away from their paychecks, and we're seeing how that reverberates through the rest of the businesses, the rest of the economy. With an income tax, one of the things that's important to remember is that, and that we're assuming, is that a portion of that income tax would be paid by non-residents, which means that, relatively speaking, the amount of damage an income tax would do to the economy is slightly less, relatively speaking, than that, for example, than the scenario where we would take PFD away from Alaskans. Those distinctions are important, right? Because what we're talking about here is how much of the money that's being raised is being raised from Alaskans versus non-residents. And then secondly, how much damage or what is the economic impact that will be felt as a result of removing this money from people's pockets?
Right. If the state income tax went through, though people would pay less federal tax.
Right.
True?
Correct, yes.
And that would actually sort of balance out a little bit. Also, you're saying that people might spend less.
Yeah.
However, the converse of that is if the state were in better fiscal health, the state could provide maybe services for the elderly, for the poor, for health, that kind of thing, which would in the long run maybe cost your average person less. There would be a saving there somehow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair inference. What we're focused on, and it's important to note that, these are short-term economic impacts or economic implications, and I always make sure that I make a distinction. All we're doing here is, again, shocking the system, if you will, or taking money away from these different options in order to understand how they actually go through the economy as a whole. So we're not assuming changes from the government provision of services standpoint or from long-term fiscal health. We're just saying that there are two things to consider. On the one hand, we're trying to close a fiscal gap. On the other hand, there is a private economy that relies heavily on consumer spending, on businesses running as usual. And in order to get the fiscal gap in order, we're going to have to undertake options that have the potential of having negative economic ramifications. And this comes, obviously, on top of an already reasonably vulnerable economy because of the previous year's decline in capital spending. And so that's really the focus here is immediately, if you go through with any of these options, what are those negative effects that can be felt and how do they play out?
Right, so less state spending is actually less money in people's pockets, less jobs, less
absolutely.
Small businesses for sure.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's really important here is that state spending is linked to the private economy. Individual spending is also linked to the private economy. And so any one of these options, anything aside from just taking money from our savings, is going to have some of these effects we're describing, right? And so you're just going to have to pick the option that A, potentially does the least amount of damage or makes the most amount of sense going forward.
How is our urban areas and rural areas different?
Yeah.
I'd assume like a tax, any tax, sales tax income would be pretty much centered on people with jobs in cities, whereas in rural Alaska, there's a few jobs.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. We don't delve into it, but I think that there is quite a bit that needs to be said about that, is that the regional effects of some of these decisions are going to be very heterogeneous, meaning no two places are going to be affected the same way. I mean, 14 of the 29 boroughs and or census areas have about at least 40% of their employment come from state and local government. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that there are cuts of state and local government workers, some of these areas that don't have basic industries that are very reliant on government spending are going to be significantly affected because they don't have alternative sources of money. Now, to your question about will the urban residents be more affected as a result of an income tax? Potentially because they're better off or they make higher incomes, but the reality is that more diversified places like Anchorage have a bit of a cushion and don't draw all their money, all their jobs from one specific sector, which means they're better suited potentially to withstand short-term shocks.
So short-term, long-term are two terms you use pretty much.
Yeah. And
are we in a long-term right now? We're looking at year two.
Sure.
And if the governor does not get his way and get the legislature to deal with this year, we're going to be looking at year three.
Mm-hmm.
Is that long term now?
Yeah, I mean, and Andrew hinted at this a little bit, and you mentioned it as well. When I use short term, really, I'm thinking immediate run. I'm thinking by the end of the year, before people have a chance to change their behavior, before businesses change their purchasing patterns, before people decide to start migrating out potentially. Now, anytime you will give people enough of a window, you start going into year two, year three, that becomes a long enough period of time for us to start seeing behavioral adjustments, right? And so that could mean people leaving the state once they lose their job. That could mean businesses only opening half a day. That could mean people eating at home instead of eating out. Those are all behavioral adjustments. It also means prices may start changing for things that we typically consume. But the trade-off that the state has to address is that of, do you hurt the economy in the short run in order to raise this money, or do you do nothing and you exacerbate the uncertainty that then makes its way into bond ratings, into difficulty in borrowing? And so that's the very real trade-off.
Right. So there is no small effect. All the small effects have a cumulative effect on the big effect. I'm glad you brought the bond rating up. Andrew did, too. This week, two other things happened. And first of all, the Department of Transportation is in negotiation with the federal highway officials over a loan called a TIFIA loan, which is necessary to move forward on the Kinnick Arm crossing. And although this is, they have previous attempts have not been successful, this is an example of a major state project that the state has put a lot of money into, which is now on hold, not because of the government, but because there's just no money for it right now. And the other project would be the Susitna-Watonna Dam. There's meetings right now downtown in Anchorage. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is taking a look at some of the environmental studies that link to that dam for future forward progress on an application process. And both of these projects would involve, you know, a lot of construction hire, a lot of state money, though, which we don't have. And these are the kind of projects that the state seems to be moving forward on in baby steps. Andrew, I want to bring you in. First of all, did you hear anything in the legislature about this loan for the Kinnick Arm crossing that is in negotiation? I know a lot of the MATSU legislators are very, very concerned with the Kinnick Arm crossing.
I spoke with an Anchorage legislator, Senate President Kevin Meyer, and he said, I mean, he basically said that it has to be seen as being on hold until the state hears otherwise. It's not going to happen unless something changes. And also, because the federal money is really, if the state does get federal money, it would be dedicated to that. It's not like the state can start counting on the money for another use There was a small amount of money in this year's budget, several million dollars, I shouldn't say small, that was dedicated to that project. And there was actually movement among Democratic legislators back when the Senate was voting on the budget to shift that toward other purposes in the operating budget. That their amendment was defeated because even at that time they didn't see progress on it occurring this year. It is important for the MATSU legislators, and so it's very much uncertain. And I think that's the reaction that is happening in the legislature.
Okay, good. It was one of Musin's comments about maybe our demographic of growth is not as big as we think it's going to be. Look, we are running out of time already, and I am really amazed that it has gone so fast. We have so much more to say. I would like to thank my guests, Andrew Kitchenman down there at KTOO in Juneau, and Musin Ghatavi right here in Anchorage with the ICER economic research folks. And I'm Ellen Lockyer. I am your host for Alaska Edition. We will see you next week with another topic of public interest. Thanks for watching.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.